Welcome to the Shortwave Report for July 20th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, The Voice of Russia, NHK World Radio Japan, and Spanish National Radio. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. As the Summer Olympics are about to begin in London, fears of terrorism and political demonstrations have MI5 and the military in high gear. Berlin just concluded a climate summit in the run-up to the World Climate Summit in Qatar in December. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees reports that more than 1 million people have now fled Somalia. China has offered $20 billion in loans to African countries over the next 3 years. Radio Deutsche Welle.
The head of Britain's domestic security agency, MI5, admits that the London Olympics will be an attractive target for terrorists, but not an easy one. In a rare public speech, Jonathan Evans said that he and his colleagues were far from complacent. He said Britain is staging its biggest ever peacetime security operation. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Mind the gap. Stand clear of the doors, please.
The last major terrorist attack on London was aimed at transportation. Muslim fanatics detonated bombs on the underground and on a bus. During the Games, therefore, the UK's whole transport system will be carefully monitored. More than 30,000 closed-circuit television cameras will watch over the entire rail network. And, says the head of Britain's transport police, Andy Trotter, hundreds of extra officers will be deployed.
It was the biggest test for us as an organisation in our history. We've obviously planned for all eventualities, and now we're going to make sure that all those things work extremely well on the day.
The security vetting has been intense. Some 600,000 people who have had or will have access to key parts of the Olympic Park have been checked out. And that includes athletes from home and abroad, and members of the so-called Olympic family, officials and sponsors. The real fear is of homegrown terrorism. The Olympic Park is situated in the East End of London. That's an area where there have been more terrorist suspects arrested in recent years than in any area of comparable size in Europe. And the games are being held in the Islamic month of Ramadan. The threat presents the police and security services with a dilemma. They must protect the public, but without harassing innocent Muslims during their holy month. Roy Ram is a former Metropolitan Police Commissioner who specialises in terrorism issues. He says the police are under huge pressure to get things exactly right.
This has got to be an intelligence-led operation. They've got to identify cells who may be plotting to do something. If they move too quickly, they can be accused of being oppressive and disruptive, particularly during the month of Ramadan. If they move too slowly, then the risk to the public is enormous.
The police and the security services have already been accused of heavy-handed overreaction in anticipating a terrorist attack or public disorder. The Olympics have been a magnet for demonstrations. This one was against China's occupation of Tibet. With the eyes of the world on London, campaigners see the Games as the perfect opportunity to protest.
There are lots of alternative places where they could build these basketball facilities. Instead, they've decided to do it on this bit of land, which is really...
This man, Simon Moore, has been protesting against the Games themselves. He objected to the use of a public open space for Olympic basketball training. The police say Moore and other protesters could distract them from the vital task of combating terrorism. So they've now had Moore banned from going within 100 metres of any Olympic venue. If he breaks this order, he risks 5 years in prison. Simon Moore is undaunted.
These punitive and coercive laws will not stop us from peacefully protesting or from doing what is right.
The government is deploying a vast array of military equipment and personnel to defend the Olympics. Jet fighters, warships, even a nuclear submarine. And some apartment blocks near the Olympic Park have had missile batteries installed on the roof. Nadine Moses, a resident, is not reassured.
It is a bit worrying that they're actually going to put missiles on the roof. And they actually are. If anything does happen, they actually will fire the missiles from the tower block. It is a bit terrifying.
Britain's Olympic defenders will be hoping that the terrorists are terrified too. They'd better be. While the athletes are running and jumping and swimming and throwing, Britain's police and security services will be spending an estimated $1.5 billion trying to keep competitors, spectators and the rest of London safe. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
German Environment Minister Peter Altmaier brought the Petersburg Climate Dialogue to a close in Berlin, saying more needs to be done to slow climate change. The meeting comes ahead of December's World Climate Summit in Qatar. Keeping the Earth's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels is one of the key ambitions of the dialogue. Altmaier said many countries could already do a lot to protect the climate and reduce their emissions, but that's not enough to stay under the limit of 2 degrees. Altmaier said the Doha conference would be a key transition in climate policy, where deals that are only binding for a few countries will give way to deals that bind everyone. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, has reported that more than 1 million people have now fled Somalia for the surrounding region. The most recent arrivals continue to cite insecurity and dwindling food resources as the main reasons for their flight. Somalia has been affected by fighting since its national government was toppled 21 years ago. It is one of the world's longest and worst refugee crises. In the past decade, only two other conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq have forced more than 1 million people to flee their homes.
Chinese President Hu Jintao has offered $20 billion in loans to African countries over the next 3 years during a speech to African leaders attending a China-Africa forum in Beijing. Hu said the fresh loans would be offered for infrastructure, agriculture, manufacturing and small and medium-sized businesses in Africa. Since backing African anti-colonialism movements in the 1950s, China has become Africa's main trading partner, reaching $166 billion last year in total, according to Chinese statistics.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. Next, the voice of Russia. The Pentagon is planning to significantly increase its presence on the African continent. While there are no specific plans to set up a military base there, both the CIA and the U.S. military have become more involved in anti-terrorist activities. The Voice of Russia.
The Pentagon is planning to significantly increase its military presence in Africa. According to General Ray Odierno, the Army's chief, at the beginning of next year, U.S. military will launch its new strategy on the continent, which would allow it to independently conduct special operations and receive additional supplies and human forces without approval from Washington. Although there are no plans yet to set up a U.S. military base in Africa, the spreading presence of the CIA and U.S. military in the region shows that Washington is serious about its plans to quell terrorist groups based out of Africa.
The general noted that Africa is becoming more and more important due to the fact that terrorist elements around the world go to the area they think has the least resistance. And right now, you could argue that's Africa. The Pentagon has two special major operation task forces on the continent, known as Joint Special Operations Task Force Trans-Sahara and Joint Special Operations Task Force Horn of Africa.
The task forces in country are under the command of Special Operations Command Africa, which is the Special Forces Wing of Africa Command, headquartered in Germany. According to General Odierno, the army is looking to do multilateral training in Africa, bringing countries from the region to conduct multilateral affairs. He added that the training and advice mission is going to be more and more important as we go forward in a post-Iraq and Afghanistan era.
The U.S. will train and advise local forces, for example, in the Ugandan quest to track and capture rebel leader Joseph Kony, who heads up the murderous Lord's Resistance Army rebel group that has been waging bloody insurgent wars against the Uganda government since the early 1990s. Last year, Washington announced that it will send 100 special forces to Uganda to help capture Kony, with additional troops coming this year.
Seizing the infamous rebel leader might be the most high-profile U.S. mission in Africa, but it's far from the only one. In fact, compared to Bush years, under President Obama, U.S. military operations in Africa have positively mushroomed. There was last year's U.S.-led NATO mission in Libya, a regional drone campaign based out of Djibouti and Ethiopia, as well as a long-time-running CIA campaign against militants in Somalia, complete with helicopter attacks, secret prisons, and U.S. commando raids.
The issue of particular concern for the U.S. now is the spreading influence of local terrorist groups, including Al-Shabaab, the Eastern Africa faction of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which has been carrying out operations in the northern and western parts of the continent throughout the last decade in places such as Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. Fueled in part by the series of grassroots revolts in the Middle East and North Africa, the two terrorist groups have joined forces with the Nigeria-based Islamic fundamentalist group Boko Haram to conduct joint attacks in East Africa.
The host of enemies also includes possible Al-Qaeda-linked militants in post-Qaddafi Libya, the violent Lord's Resistance Army in the Central African Republic, Congo and South Sudan, Mali's Islamist rebels of the Ansar Dine, and guerrillas from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula across the Gulf of Aden in Yemen. The U.S. also has had troops deployed in Mali, despite having officially suspended military relations with that country following a coup.
To conduct its ambitious missions, the U.S. needs a whole string of semi-official military camps and supply routes in Africa. According to research by Tom Dispatch, cited by Al Jazeera, the U.S. Navy has an operating location known as Camp Gilbert in Dire Dawa, Ethiopia. U.S. military documents indicate that there may be other lower-profile U.S. facilities in the country. In addition to Camp Limonier in Djibouti, the U.S. military also maintains another outpost in the country, a Navy port facility without a name, which AFRICOM chooses to keep mum about.
In addition, the U.S. is conducting counter-terrorism training and equipping militaries in Algeria, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mauritania, Niger, and Tunisia. AFRICOM also has 14 major joint training exercises planned for 2012, including operations in Morocco, Cameroon, Gabon, Botswana, South Africa, Lesotho, Senegal, and Nigeria. According to Pat Barnes, a spokesman for U.S. Africa Command, there are on average basis approximately 5,000 U.S. military and DoD personnel working across the continent at any one time. 3,000 more U.S. soldiers will be transferred to Africa next year.
Substantial financial investment on the part of the Pentagon is also expected, with up to $180 million or more to be spent on construction at Camp Limonier alone. Military documents also indicate that about $50 million are to be spent on Camp Simba in Kenya, in addition to the $450,000 exercise facility which was just built at the U.S. base in Entebbe, Uganda last year. And according to most estimates, the U.S. military buildup in Africa has only just begun. What will come of it? Judging by what has happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, a foreign presence will only result in fierce military resistance and more overlapping regional conflicts.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15425-9800 or 9665 or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Last Monday saw the largest anti-nuclear demonstration to date since the Fukushima disaster last year. A second nuclear reactor has been restarted despite public outcry. Experts now want surveys of earthquake faults that lie beneath a number of the nuclear reactors, including the two that are now restarted. A village in Fukushima Prefecture has been divided into three areas based on radiation levels. The United Arab Emirates has approved construction of the country's first nuclear power plant. The United Arab Emirates has begun using an oil pipeline that allows delivery without passing through the Straits of Hormuz. NHK World Radio Japan.
Tens of thousands of people have staged one of the biggest anti-nuclear rallies in Tokyo since the Fukushima accident in March last year. Labor union activists joined members of the public in the main protest rally at Yoyogi Park on Monday. Many of them responded to calls on the social network Twitter, as well as the internet. Nobel Prize-winning author Kenzaburo Oe was among public figures who called on people to take to the streets. The rally came after a reactor at the Oe nuclear power plant in Fukui Prefecture, central Japan, was brought back online. It began operating at full capacity earlier this month. Oe said the government's move to push forward the restarting of idled reactors, despite wide public opposition, is an insult to the people. He added that people must defeat this move. Organizers say 170,000 people took part in the rally, while police estimate the number at 75,000. The crowd then marched onto the streets to protest the restart of the reactor and show their opposition to nuclear power. A woman took part with her son, who is in elementary school. She said she wants the government to scrap nuclear plants immediately for the safety of her child. A man in his 70s said he joined the rally because the government won't listen to the people. He added that he cannot accept its decision to restart the reactor.
The second nuclear reactor in Japan to be restarted since the Fukushima accident has reached criticality. Kansai Electric Power Company says the Oii plant's number 4 reactor began its self-sustaining chain reaction on Thursday morning. The number 3 reactor has been operating at maximum capacity for the past 10 days. Senior Vice Industry Minister Seishu Makino oversaw the turning on of the number 4 reactor on Wednesday evening. The company says the reactor will begin generating electricity on Saturday and will be fully operational by next Wednesday. With the two reactors in operation, the government plans to review its power-saving targets for this summer in the surrounding area, including the possible lifting of restrictions. Meanwhile, a call by experts for further surveys of the plant site has raised concerns. They want the utility to check whether cracks below the plant are active faults, which could lead to future earthquakes. The Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency on Wednesday instructed the utility to investigate the cracks.
Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency has ordered power companies to assess underground cracks below two nuclear power plants on the Sea of Japan coast to determine whether or not they're active faults. Experts with the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency suggested on Tuesday that further studies are needed on a 900-meter underground fissure that runs north to south between the number 2 and number 3 reactors and Oii nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture. They said a lack of data about the fissure led them to propose the investigation. The experts also said a crack running 250 meters below the number 1 reactor at Shika nuclear plant in Ishikawa Prefecture is highly likely to be an active fault, but that analysis has been insufficient. The agency on Wednesday instructed the plant's operators, Kansai Electric and Hokuriku Electric, to survey the sites. The number 3 reactor at the Oii plant is currently in operation after recently being brought back online. The agency says it will not order the reactor stopped for the survey, but that the outcome could affect their operation. The agency has already ordered a reassessment of fissures at the Tsuruga nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture and the Higashidori nuclear plant in Aomori Prefecture. The government's quake resistance guidelines do not allow construction of key nuclear facilities directly above active faults. This means the number 1 reactor at Shika plant might never be restarted.
A village in Fukushima Prefecture has been divided into three areas according to accessibility. One area has been fenced off because of a high level of radioactive contamination. Nearly all of the 6,000 residents were removed from Itate village after the March 2011 accident at the nearby Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The village was reclassified into three areas on Tuesday. Six fences were set up along the border of the no-entry zone, which is expected to be uninhabitable for a long time. At midnight, government officials locked three of the six fences with coated bolts. Only people who own homes in the area will be allowed to enter using the code, but their stay will be limited from morning to evening. They will be prohibited from staying overnight in their homes. The rezoning is part of the government's review of no-entry and evacuation zones set up in 11 municipalities in Fukushima Prefecture after the nuclear accident. Full-fledged decontamination work will start in Itate Village, focusing on homes so residents can return. But there is no plan yet to decontaminate wooded land and paddy fields, which cover 85% of the village. The United Arab Emirates has approved the construction of the country's first nuclear power plant. It's the first time since the Fukushima accident that any government has agreed to allow a new nuclear plant to be built. The UAE's Federal Authority for Nuclear Regulation announced on Wednesday that it's agreed to the construction of two reactors. The plant is scheduled to begin operating by 2017. A member of the authority, Ahmad Al-Kabi, says they discuss ways to improve the independence of the regulatory body following the Fukushima accident before they gave approval. The Middle Eastern oil-rich country will be the first Arab state to build a nuclear power plant. The country says it's taking the step to cope with rapid urbanization and population growth. It expects the country's electricity demand will increase three times by 2020. A consortium, including Japanese firms, competed against the South Korean rival for the contract. But in the end, the Korean group won with the help of top diplomacy, in which President Im Yong-bak himself visited the UAE.
A senior United Arab Emirates official has stressed the significance of a new oil pipeline bypassing the Strait of Hormuz. The UAE began pumping crude oil through the 400-kilometer-long pipeline on Sunday. It connects the Habshan oil fields in the west of the UAE with the eastern port city of Fujairah on the Gulf of Oman. Fujairah's official in charge of ports, Sharif Awari, told NHK on Monday the completion of the pipeline is a positive development given the rising tension in the region. He suggested the pipeline could counter threats by Iran to block the Strait of Hormuz. The UAE is Japan's second largest supplier of crude oil, next to Saudi Arabia. The UAE sends its oil through the Persian Gulf and the Strategic Strait.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162. Willits, California, 95490. Please support independently produced radio like a listener in Redwood Valley, California did this week. Donations are the only source of funding for this weekly program. We will conclude with Spanish National Radio. Public sector workers, including firemen, police, and school teachers, are taking to the streets daily in opposition to Spain's austerity measures. El País featured the public sector march and the Popular Party senator who had publicly made an obscene remark about those who oppose the austerity measures. Spain's economy minister denies that the government intends to shut down the ailing banks. Hillary Clinton visited Egypt and Israel. In Egypt, her car was pelted with tomatoes. In Israel, she reaffirmed U.S. support. Spanish National Radio.
Public sector workers, including firemen, police, and school teachers, are continuing their now nearly daily protests as thousands of people in Madrid blocked traffic today on a few major thoroughfares. Municipal employees dressed in mourning staged a mock funeral. They are protesting the most recent government cuts with slogans such as "Hands up, this is a stick-up," and "Let the politicians lose their jobs."
Last Friday, the government approved raising value-added tax to 21%, cutting public sector workers' salaries by about 7% by eliminating the 14th wage instalment they receive at Christmas and reducing unemployment compensation.
El País carries a front-page colour photo of the march by protesting public sector workers in Madrid yesterday and prints the caption, "Public workers come out against the cuts." The paper notes that the protesters walked past the heavily guarded Congress and the Popular Party headquarters where police dispersed them. Teachers, healthcare workers, police and firemen took part in the protest.
Below the photo, the paper runs the headline, "The Popular Party gives protesters their slogan." El País is referring to an incident last week in which a Popular Party senator, Andrea Fabra, applauding the Prime Minister in Congress as he announced the new reduction in employment subsidies, exclaimed, and I quote, "Farm." The senator's remark has caused a stir, with opposition members and sectors of society calling for her resignation. The Popular Party stands by her and insists she was not addressing the jobless. The paper says Ms. Fabra's words have increased protesters' indignation and even worried Popular Party leadership.
Spain's economy minister Luis de Guindos has denied that the government is planning to close down any of Spain's banks in financial troubles. His statement came shortly after the new governor of the Bank of Spain, Luis María Linde, said he believes that the banks that cannot demonstrate that they are viable should be wound down in an orderly fashion.
The central banker, who took over the post last month, was speaking to a parliamentary committee and is the first high-level Spanish official to speak of the liquidation of banks in the restructuring process which the system is undergoing. On Friday, Eurozone finance ministers are due to agree the final details of the 100 billion euro bailout package for Spanish banks agreed in June.
The U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Israel, where she met President Shimon Peres. She flew to Jerusalem, fresh from a visit to Egypt, where she became the most senior U.S. official to meet the newly elected President Mohamed Morsi from the long-banned Muslim Brotherhood. Mr. Morsi told her Egypt would abide by its treaties. Protesters in Egypt, angry over Ms. Clinton's support of their former president, Hosni Mubarak, pelted her car as it raced past.
In Jerusalem, Ms. Clinton sought to reassure a wary Israel worried about the rise of Islamists in neighboring Egypt, but stressed the U.S.'s continuing support for Israel.
And it is in moments like these that friends like us have to think together, act together. We are called to be smart, creative, and courageous.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 6055 and podcasting at rtve.es. Also, World Radio is now mostly podcasting Spanish National Radio shows at their website, wrn.org. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts. You could use a shortwave radio at home, which is simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy, maybe easier. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.